Good evening and welcome. Before we get started, I have just turned off my cell phone, and I would like to suggest that everybody in the room here at the University of Wisconsin do that as well. I also want to let you know that this lecture, this program, is being live webcast on the internet. I'm going to tell you about who some of the audience members are for all of that in just a moment. But welcome to The Making of the Fittest, Sean Carroll's lecture on natural selection and the DNA record of evolution. My name is Kendall Crolius, and I represent the small army of volunteers who are running the Darwin 150 project. It is a multifaceted organization and project. This is the third in a series of five lectures with leading scientists, all of which are being made available by free webcast online. We also have phone-based reading groups on Origin of Species, and we have a web-based archive now of these lectures and these reading groups in podcast and video format so that you can access anything that you have missed to date. And all of this is run by a volunteer-led nonprofit called Reading Odyssey. And I encourage you to check us out at readingodyssey.com. We have, in addition to the live audience here at the University of Wisconsin, we have over 70 high schools, colleges, science museums, and other institutions around the world who are joining us with groups, some as many as several hundred, some as many as the audience that we have here at the University of Wisconsin, as well as literally thousands of individuals. And you can see this is a long list of institutions. I will just mention a few: the American Museum of Natural History, Collegiate School in New York, the oldest school in the country, Evansville High School, right here in Wisconsin, not too far away, Georgia Tech, Harvard, the Indian Institute of Science Education in India, Iowa State, MIT, the Ecology Institute at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, St. Louis University, Texas A&M, who've been with us from the beginning, the University of Barcelona in Spain, the University of Hyderabad in India, the Universitat of Munster in Germany, the University of York in the UK. So this is truly a global audience of scientists, scholars, and lay people who are interested in this topic. This is intended to be an interactive session, and we're going to have a question and answer period here live with this audience, but the global audience is going to participate as well, and they will be emailing questions to pterry@readingodyssey.com. My colleague Phil is standing by his computer and is going to relay questions to me that I will then pose to Sean. Let me not take up any more time. It is now time to introduce our distinguished speaker. Sean Carroll is a professor of molecular biology and genetics and an investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute here at the University of Wisconsin. His research is centered on the genes that control animal body patterns and play major roles in the evolution of animal diversity. Major discoveries from Sean's laboratory have been featured in Time, U.S. News and World Report, The New York Times, Discover, and Natural History. Sean has earned many scientific honors. In fact, so many that he made me take them all out of the introduction because he said nobody wants to hear that. He's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Sean is also a prolific author. His books include Endless Forms Most Beautiful, The New Science of Evo Devo, and The Making of the Fittest, the book on which tonight's lecture is based. His most recent book, Remarkable Creatures, has just been named a finalist for the National Book Award in Nonfiction. And Sean also writes a monthly feature on a regular basis for the New York Times, Science Times. What's truly extraordinary about Sean is that he is not only a highly respected scientist, but he is widely known for his remarkable ability to communicate his love of science to a broad audience. And that is why we are so excited and so honored to have Sean address our audience here at the University of Wisconsin and the thousands of people who are joining us from around the world. So please join me in welcoming Sean Carroll.
Well, you know, your evolution, that's all a load of rubbish, isn't it? It's not true, is it? It's a load of rubbish. How can you possibly evolve a set of wings? It's not going to happen, is it? I mean, I'd like a set of wings. I'd love a set of wings. In fact, if I could have anything, I'd definitely have a set of wings. But it wouldn't matter how many times I jumped off a tall building, I'd never grow wings. And even if I jumped off a tall building and then my child jumped off a tall building and his child jumped off a tall building and we did that forever and ever and ever, there is not the slightest chance that wings would grow out of my back.
We all started off much the same kind of thing. We all were waddling along in our bellies to begin with. Then we grew arms and heads and legs, and some of us got up and walked, and some of us stayed down crawling around. But no, I'm glad I've evolved the way I am. I wouldn't like to have been further back in the evolutionary scale.
I think we've evolved to our full potential. I think we have.
Possibly.
It's hard to...
Maybe not on an intellectual basis, because every day
it's hard to...
more and more.
Hard to see how you can improve further, isn't it?
We'd be able to do some good tricks if we had a couple more legs. I'm sure we'd be able to work out some new stunts for the show, so that could be a positive advantage, definitely at this stage.
Depends whose legs they were, doesn't it, right?
I think, obviously we'd adapt in whatever way if we had extra legs, but...
You were in it, wouldn't it? If you had six legs, where would your ass be?
Yeah.
I think we are a process of evolution. I think we are not the top of the pinnacle. We are just a branch, I think. I just think, at the end of the day, it's about genetic transport. Basically, we're just hauling genomes along in a bag, which is our body, from century to century. I think that's what it's all about, folks, you know?
That you enjoyed those excerpts from Nick Park's brilliant Creature Comforts series. Thank you, Kendall. Thank you to the Darwin 150 Project for this opportunity. Thank you to the sponsors for making this possible, including Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation and the Mortgage Institute for Research. Thank all of you for coming tonight and skipping the World Series. And thank you especially to the web audience for tuning in, wherever you may be and whatever time zone you may be in. Those creatures and that brilliant series, they tell us a lot about how new capabilities evolve, and they raise questions about genes and genomes. And my pleasure tonight is to update you on some of the great progress that's being made in understanding how evolution works. What I want to do is show you some more amazing and wonderful creatures. I promise from here on out they're all going to be real. And the first of which, and perhaps the most amazing animal I know of, well, it requires us to go back in time on a voyage a long time ago. No, not that voyage you're thinking about. Still a long time ago. Of a ship called the SS Norvegia. Now, in the late 1920s, the whale stocks of the Northern Atlantic had been fished out. And the government of Norway was concerned that to allow for that industry to continue thriving, it had to find new stocks. So it was very interested in the Southern Ocean. And in late 1927, it sent this ship, the Norvegia, to the Southern Ocean with really three missions in mind. The first mission was to establish a shelter for either ships in distress or shipwrecked sailors. You can see from this picture that these are really rough waters. Lots of ice, lots of hazards to navigation, lots of danger for wooden boats. And in late 1927, the Norvegia made its way towards its first destination. And this may be one of the most remote places on the planet, deep in the Southern Ocean, a place called Bouvet Island. Now, this snow-covered, ice-covered rock jutting out of the middle of the ocean doesn't look too hospitable, but as you'll see shortly, it's the only place to go in a vast expanse of this water. Now, this picture was actually taken as the Norvegia approached Bouvet Island. And it was taken by a young zoologist on board named Ditlef Rusted. Now, there was a practice in the Norwegian fleet to send zoology students out with the fleet, particularly to be involved in surveys of marine life. And that's one thing Ditlef was doing on board, but he was also doubling as the ship photographer. Now, I told you this was a remote place. Let's look at the map to see where Bouvet is. That's it, a little speck in the Southern Ocean, far from South Africa, far from South America, far from continental Antarctica, and pretty far even from maybe an island you've heard of, South Georgia Island. This is the island to which Shackleton rowed in 1916 to save the crew of the Endurance. So about November 30th, 1927, the Norvegia made it close to Bouvet, but a snowstorm prevented them from landing a small boat. But the next day, the weather cleared, and they paddled in on a small boat to accomplish their second task, which was to claim Bouvet Island for the country of Norway. And here they are. I'm trying to think where that saying comes from. Okay. Now, it turns out that Bouvet had already been claimed by Britain, but I'll get to that part of the story shortly. And this is, in fact, Ditlef Rusted here on the far left. So here they are, and they can stash some provisions there and take care of that part of their duty. But the third mission of this boat was to conduct research on the marine life in these waters. And once they had sort of established themselves at Bouvet, they set up a routine where the ship would patrol around the island, and they would take small boats to explore some of the smaller rock formations right around the island. And what Ditlef Rusted did was he would just toss a net over the back of the boat and trawl up whatever he could find in the water. And one day, in fact, the day after Christmas, 1927, he pulled up a really peculiar-looking fish. This fish. Now, some of the old hands on the boat identified it as an ice fish, named for its white, almost translucent appearance. And then Russ said, notice, I mean, this is a weird-looking fish in terms of its protruding jaws. It was clearly a predator, but obviously its body proportions look a little bit strange. So he was intrigued, and he brought the fish aboard, and he did what any good Norwegian would do. He filleted it. And when he opened this fish up, he got the shock of his life. Well, let me show you what he confronted. I'll show you a modern photograph. What he confronted when he looked at the blood of this particular fish. This is what ice fish blood looks like. It's colorless. Unlike any other fish that Ditlef or any other biologist had seen to that time, which is typical red blood like you and I have. So Rusted was surprised. He made notice. He took some photographs of the fish splayed open on deck. But this was just the beginning of the Norvegia's voyage. There were many more islands to visit. So Rusted made his notes and on the ship went, and he did a long tour before returning back home to Norway. He really had put it out of his mind. Until about 2 years later, another zoology student returned from his own voyage in the Southern Ocean, bumped into Rusted and said, you know, I was out on this whaling ship, and these old hands, they were pulling my leg. They were saying something about a bloodless ice fish. And Rusted said to him, I've seen such a fish. Now, this second zoology student, Johan Rude, he was really taken aback. What do you mean you've seen such a fish? He said, I'll show you the photographs. He said, yes, I've seen. Their blood is colorless. Well, now Rude, who never saw an ice fish in all the time of his voyage, he's now just really curious. And this idea of the bloodless ice fish grips him. And every time voyagers come back from the Southern Oceans, he's asking them, did you see these fish? Did you see these fish? And this goes on for more than 20 years. Sometimes some specimens get brought back and pickled in formaldehyde and things like that. Not anything he could really study. And he decides he's going to settle this question of the bloodless ice fish once and for all by traveling back to the Southern Ocean himself. So in 1953, 25 years later, he travels all the way to South Georgia Island, sets up a makeshift laboratory, sends out a call for ice fish, and a few are quickly brought to him. He draws their blood, immediately notices, yes, it's colorless. And when he looks at it in detail, he notices, if he spins this, for example, this centrifuge tube down, that only 1% of their whole blood volume is cellular at all. And when he looks under the microscope, all those cells are white cells. This fish, he confirms, has no red blood cells at all. 99% of his blood is just plasma. Well, this is really strange. How strange? Well, he had studied lots of other fish, and if you just compare the ice fish with other red-blooded fish in the southern waters, when you spin their blood down, about 15 to 18% of their blood volume is packed red blood cells. If you spin yours and my blood down, about 45% of our blood volume is red blood cells. And anything less than that 45% we call anemia, and anything significantly less than that is life-threatening. How in the world are the ice fish getting by with no red blood cells at all? Now, there's about 15 species of the ice fish, and they're the only vertebrates, the only animals with backbones on the entire planet that lack red blood cells. All the other fish have them. Reptiles, birds, mammals, all have red blood cells. So somehow these fish have ditched a way of life that nurtured their ancestors for at least 500 million years. Now, Johan Rude studied their blood very carefully, and he determined that the level of oxygen in their blood was the same level of oxygen as in the surrounding seawater. And he studied the anatomy of these fish, and he was really struck that they had unusually large hearts for their body size and really large capillaries, and they were virtually scaleless. And so he deduced that it looks like what they're doing is they're pumping much more of this very oxygen-poor blood around their tissues and absorbing a lot of that oxygen through their skin from the surrounding water. Now, why would the fish be living this lifestyle? And Rude surmised that it must have something to do with the extreme environment in which they were living. These waters of the Southern Ocean are 29 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit. And he thought, well, this must have something to do with it. And when you think about it, and all the people here from Wisconsin can appreciate this, that in very cold temperatures, it's a little harder to push around viscous fluids, like cell-containing blood. So maybe what the ice fish have done is they've just removed those cells from their blood, and now it's a lot easier to pump that liquid around. So that was Johan Rude's idea, that this was somehow an adaptation to the very cold temperatures, and that this was an adaptation that reduced the viscosity of their blood and made it easier to pump in these extremely cold waters. So he was on the right path, but that's about all we could say about the origin of these fish was that they were unusual and that there was a group of them, all of these bloodless ice fish. So we have to ask, what on earth would cause them to do this? And to answer a question like that, we have to think about the history of the part of the world that they live in, especially the geological history. And the geological history of this part of the world is really important. We know that about 40 million years ago, South America and the Antarctic continent were still connected. And about 33 to 34 million years ago, you know, give or take a week, a channel opened, what we now refer to as Drake's Passage. And over time, the waters around the Antarctic became much more isolated and colder, such that where 40 million years ago, the average water temperature was about 50 degrees Fahrenheit around the Antarctic, today it's 29 to 30 degrees. So clearly there's been dramatic geological changes in this part of the world, dramatic changes in the oceans in terms of temperatures. So the ice fish must be doing something to keep up with these dramatic changes. So how did these fish adapt to these geological changes? Well, normally the way we would answer or pursue a question like that, the place we would look for clues would be the fossil record. But we're out of luck. There is no fossil record for these fish. And even if we had a fossil record, we wouldn't necessarily be able to tell from those bones whether the fish fossils had red blood or white blood. So what can we do? Well, while there's no fossil record, there is a record of the ice fish that we can tap into, and that's the DNA record. And this DNA record is a massive, information-rich document that reveals to us what was lost and what was gained and what was modified in the course of ice fish evolution. Now, what I want to do first is share with you a couple of stories from the ice fish DNA record that really illustrate the changes that took place in the ice fish as this part of the world was changing. And then I'm going to tell you lots more stories about some other creatures in the course of the evening. So what do we know from this DNA record? Well, the first thing I'm going to tell you about is a loss. It may not be the first thing you'd think about when you look at the DNA record is to find out what's gone, but you'll see it makes a lot of sense with respect to what I told you about red blood cells just a few minutes ago. If we look in red-blooded fish and we look at a particular chromosome and we look for the genes that encode the chains of the hemoglobin molecule. Now, this is the molecule that carries oxygen in these fish and in you and I. And it's encoded by two genes that sit next to each other. If we look at a red-blooded fish, there they are. But if we look in an ice fish, a bloodless ice fish, these two genes, which I've denoted here with this green bar here in this candy stripe pattern here, the green gene, it's gone completely, missing entirely. And the stripe gene, it's just a truncated remnant. And the code of that truncated remnant is sort of disintegrating. It's a lousy-looking gene. There's enough of a resemblance that we can tell it was a globin gene, but it's not good anymore. So we have right here in the genome evidence of a dramatic genetic change that reflects the dramatic physiological change that's taken place in these animals. And we look at this gene, what we see is it's accumulated so many mutations. It's just the text of the gene is eroding away, much as the same way that a fossil would erode, you know, from a rock bed when exposed to the elements. So we refer to these as fossil genes. Old pieces of text still in DNA, no longer working, but telling us something about changes in current species that make them different from their ancestors. So think about these fish. They've abandoned red blood cells. They've abandoned the genes for hemoglobin. They've punched a one-way ticket to a hemoglobinless lifestyle for the rest of their future. It's not coming back. Okay, now evolution's not all about losses. It's also about invention. And these fish, and some of their close relatives have a really nifty invention. Now think about the waters that they live in. I told you it's 29 to 30 degrees, and if you've ever seen footage of the Antarctic, you know that it's very icy. There's big icebergs, there's lots of slush floating in the water, underwater there's lots of ice crystals. And these are hazards to navigation for these ice fish. Because as these ice fish feed, and they are predators, there's a danger. Their tissues are full of water, as are yours and mine. And if they happen to ingest little crystals of ice, that can nucleate ice formation. And, well, you got a fish stick, right? Frozen from the inside out. So these fish, to cope with these extremely cold waters, they've come up with an invention. Antifreeze. Ice fish and their closest relatives, turns out that their blood and their tissues are chock full of a really peculiar family of proteins that serve as antifreezes that depress the temperature at which ice crystals can grow. And there's so much antifreeze in these fish, it suppresses the temperature at which ice fish can, that ice can grow by a couple of degrees. Just enough margin to allow these fish to survive in 29-degree water. Remember, that water's about 3 degrees colder than the freezing temperature of fresh water. Well, yes, these are peculiar proteins, but what's really neat about the story of antifreeze is that scientists at the University of Illinois, led by Art DeVries and Chris Cheng, have been able to trace the origin of the antifreeze genes. And they've really captured the evolutionary events that gave rise to this entirely new function. What they were able to find is that the antifreeze is made up of a really repeating, unusual repeating sequence. And they captured that gene inside another gene, in such a way that it told them that the antifreeze gene had evolved from a little bit of code of another gene, and in fact encoded a digestive enzyme. So it's really one of our best cases of sort of taking a snapshot of evolution in action and seeing where an entirely new function could come from. And in this case, the entirely new function is one that enabled the ice fish and its closest antifreeze-bearing relatives to invade a hostile habitat, to take advantage of the rich resources, these oxygen-rich waters of the Southern Ocean are actually great feeding grounds. And they now dominate the biomass, the fish biomass anyway, of the Southern Ocean. Ice fish and other antifreeze-bearing fish make up about 90% of the Antarctic fish biomass. So this is a key invention that allowed a group to really flower. Now we know actually from the fossil record that other fish were there 40 million years ago, skates and sharks and flounders and typical fish like that. They're not there today. They either went extinct or had to migrate north as those waters got colder. So the ice fish and other antifreeze-bearing fish are exploiting this habitat that other fish could not adapt to. So key innovation. Well, what this DNA record of the ice fish allows us to see, of course, are these changes. They document the changes that have been taking place in these creatures as they've been adapting to the changing Earth. The DNA record of the ice fish, and really of all species, reveals three themes that I want to hit on repeatedly tonight as I tell you some other stories about some other creatures. First of all, the Earth and the life and life evolved together. And what I mean by that is Earth has been changing since its formation. So the creatures on Earth have to keep up with that ever-changing Earth. The ice fish had to keep up with the freezing Southern Ocean. And all the creatures on the planet have been trying to keep up with this ever-changing Earth, wherever they may live, in all sorts of habitats. Secondly, that when we look at the DNA record of the ice fish and of other species, we see that shifts in lifestyle are reflected in the DNA of pertinent genes. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, ice fish have about 20,000 genes. And some of those have changed in the course of their adaptation to these cold waters, and some have not. And what we're doing is pinpointing those that have changed and sorting them out from the ones that haven't and figuring out what sort of biological sense that makes. So we've seen they've lost their globin genes and they've invented antifreeze. That's just a few
or a couple of the many changes that have taken place in these fish. And the third thing that's revealed by the DNA record and most pertinent to the topic tonight are Darwin's principles of natural selection. Now, since I brought up the great man, let me tell you what I'm talking about. So this is the most condensed passage I could show you from The Origin of Species that really gives you the essence of his idea of natural selection. And let's just walk through it, and I boldface the really key terms, the ingredients, if you like, into this process that Darwin and Alfred Wallace discovered. Darwin says, "Can it then be thought improbable that other variations, useful in some way to each being in the great and complex battle of life," great and complex battle of life. This was a dramatic change in the perception of nature. This was Darwin, having been out in the wild on his great voyage, he realized life is a battlefield. All organisms are not in some harmony sort of placed there like, you know, sort of a Victorian painter would. No, there's a battle. There's a battle for resources, and it's intense. And he said, if such variations could occur in the course of thousands of generations, time. Darwin was trained as a geologist. I think he, more than any other naturalist, thinking about life anyway, grasped the vastness of time, gave him a huge advantage in conceiving the history of life. He said, if such do occur, can we doubt, remembering that many more individuals are born than could possibly survive, that individuals having any advantage, however slight over others, would have the best chance of surviving and procreating their kind. Now, people often forget this part, but it's a key ingredient in natural selection. On the other hand, we may feel sure that any variation in the least degree injurious would be rigidly destroyed. So variations that are injurious will be destroyed, but this preservation of favorable variations and the rejection of injurious variations, I call natural selection. So Darwin saw two sides of the coin. A variation could be advantageous, but a variation could also be injurious, and natural selection would favor the one and reject the other. And I want you to keep these principles in mind as I tell you some more stories about some other creatures, because some variations, whether they are good or bad, depend upon the conditions. So this great and complex battle of life that Darwin perceived, we now know it leaves a record in DNA. Now, I was telling you that it's an information-rich document. I want to give you some of that scale. About 25 years ago, if you took all of the DNA sequence that all the biologists on the planet had put together, sort of typed it out into its four letters, A, C, G, and T, and printed it in a book, it would fill the size of about one novel. If you took all the DNA sequence that we have today, printed out in those books, stacked those books, it's more than 2 miles high. And for the last 8 or 10 years, we biologists have been mining this record for insights into the process of evolution. So what I want to do tonight is give you a few highlights, and I think some profound surprises from this DNA record. And in the course of my talk, I'm going to tell you some stories about some more creatures and some of the steps in evolution that we can now see in exact detail. The most fundamental level at which evolution takes place, changes in DNA. Most of the stories I'm going to tell you, some you may not have heard before, most are not in textbooks, but they soon will be. And then, in the last few minutes of my talk, I want to discuss how maybe this DNA record might shift the balance of conversation eventually in the United States regarding the acceptance of evolution. Now, to illustrate this battle, I'm going to focus on just one dimension of the great and complex battle of life. I'm going to focus on the evolutionary game of hide and seek, the great battle between seeing and not being seen, which has been going on in the animal kingdom for more than 500 million years. I could have talked about almost anything tonight. There's all sorts of studies that evolutionary biologists are understanding the process from. But I thought to sort of keep us a little bit contained here, this is, I think, the one that's most intuitive. That animals are often either trying to escape being seen or they're trying to advertise themselves to other animals. And other animals are trying to see things that are hard to see. And I'm going to tell you stories along both of those lines. Now, I'm going to take you then to a battlefield where this game of hide and seek can still be witnessed today. And this battlefield is in southern Arizona, actually extends into northern Mexico, called the Pinacate Lava Flow. And you'll notice right away something unusual about the ground there. Because while you see these beautiful saguaro cacti dotting the landscape, they are growing out of black soil, volcanic soil. And at various places, you can see these outcrops of volcanic rock. And if you've been to this part of the country, you know that there's been all sorts of volcanic eruptions across Arizona. There are cinder cones out there. There's all sorts of lava flows. And over the last million years, a lot of the landscape of the desert Southwest has been marked by these eruptions. I'll show you, the landscape is heterogeneous. Here's one of those lava flows cutting across sort of sandy, scrubby desert. So you can just sort of be walking through the desert, and all of a sudden you'll just see one of these little fingers of lava flow. And you can see this lava flow has been around long enough that you see some plants taking hold, some beautiful flowers, and some grasses and things that are growing on them. And in order for this habitat to be used, to be invaded, obviously it has to break down a little bit. But this volcanic soil is pretty rich, so it does hold some potential for the creatures of the desert. Now, a lot of the places of the desert, it's a very rocky landscape with just these sandy-colored boulders. Now, this battlefield has been well studied by Michael Nachman and his colleagues at the University of Arizona, who gave me all these pictures. And this battlefield is home to the majestic, the magnificent, and I believe the soon-to-be iconic rock pocket mouse. Now, Michael has drawn some portraits of these mice, or photographed these mice, in various settings. Now, what's important about these mice, this is all one species, and it comes in two flavors. And I say flavors because Michael's referred to these mice as the Snickers bars of the desert. These beautiful little mice, they are the favorite chow of snakes and birds and lizards and I don't know what else. And you may notice, as he's taking these pictures, that in certain settings, they match their backgrounds pretty well. In others, they don't. So here you have a sandy-colored mouse on a sandy rock. You have a chocolate-colored mouse on a sandy rock. It sticks out pretty nicely. Here's a chocolate-colored mouse blending on the volcanic rock. Here's a sandy-colored mouse sticking out on the lava flow. Now, why does all this matter? Well, these mice have been well studied for about 80 years by naturalists. We know a lot about their habits. We know a lot about their distribution across the desert. We know a lot about their predators. And if you think about these mice, you might imagine that a dark mouse sitting on sandy rock, well, it sort of sticks out. And if there's a bird coming by, that might be it. But of course, for the sandy-colored mouse, you know, on the other background, if it happened to wander up onto one of these lava flows, well, it's lunch. Okay? And it turns out this is exactly what's going on in the desert. If you go out there today, 99% of the mice you'll find in the open desert are sandy-colored, and 99% of the mice you'll find on the lava flows are chocolate. And they don't know the difference. There's no behavioral difference between these mice. What's happening is the predators are pruning these populations of mice to give you that distribution. They're under intense selection by predators on the basis of color matching. Now, that's great. It's a great field, real-time, real-life example of natural selection. But what makes this story more powerful is that Michael and his colleagues know the exact genetic basis that makes these two colors of mice different from one another. I'm going to introduce you to this gene. It's the only gene. I'm going to name maybe one or two more genes tonight. It's called MC1R. It will come up again a little bit later in the talk. And what we know is that mice that are sandy-colored, they have two copies of sort of the light version of this gene. And mice that are chocolate-colored, well, they have one or two copies of an alternative version of this gene that has two mutations in it. And what we know has happened is that ancestrally, these mice were sandy-colored. And then there were these lava flows. And in order for these mice, any part of the population of this species, to invade those lava flows and to exploit the resources that were there in those lava flows. As that rock breaks down and grasses grow there, these mice like to, they're seed eaters, and they like to store seeds in their cheek pouches. In order to exploit those resources, they got to get up on those lava flows. But sandy-colored mice are obviously sitting ducks. Dark-colored mice can make it. And so as mutations occurred at random in the population of desert mice, those dark mice had an advantage and could exploit those resources on the lava. So this is an example of two important ideas. First, again, life evolving along with the Earth. Those lava flows were geologic changes in the neighborhood. This is how the mice kept up with them. And the second point is about the conditional nature of mutations and evolution. Mutation often has a negative connotation. Not at all true. Whether a mutation is good or bad depends upon the circumstances. For sandy-colored mice out in the open desert, that dark mutation is bad. It makes them conspicuous. But for mice living near the lava flow and exploring it, that dark mutation was an advantage. So, natural selection, it's a very conditional process. Now, the reason why I told you this story is it's a completely buttoned-up example of natural selection. We know the agents of selection, the predators. We know a lot about these mice and their distribution, their ecology, their habitats. We know the history of the region in terms of its geology. And we know the genetic basis of the adaptation that allows the mice to adapt to the lava flows. That's it. That's how natural selection works. All wrapped up. Okay. So I'm going to tell you one more story about this game of hide and seek, but I'm going to switch it around here to where the seeker has evolved a nifty trick. And this story, well, it also involves rodents. Okay. You skipped the World Series for rodents. What can I say? It involves the field vole of Northern Europe. Now, this is not shown to scale. If I had shown this to scale, you wouldn't see this vole. This is a Monty Python-sized vole, okay? You wouldn't see it in the green grass of Northern Europe. It's a tiny little vole. And it's the favorite meal of a beautiful bird, the European kestrel. Now, think of the challenge this kestrel has. It's flying over these green fields, the tall grass. It's looking for voles. How, from altitude, is this bird going to find a tiny little vole? Right? Remember, it's not that big. It's going to use its vision, but to help you appreciate how it uses its vision, I've got to give you a little introduction to vision in animals, and particularly to color vision. So we're going to take a little short digression, and I'm going to tell you about the world of color vision. The world of color vision as we perceive it, because we can see in what's called full color vision, are all the colors of the rainbow, from violet to deep red. And the way these colors are detected is that there are proteins in our retina that are excited by various wavelengths of light. And these proteins are called opsins. And in humans, we have three genes that encode these opsins that equip us with this ability to see all the colors of the rainbow. And I'm giving you a little schematic here of the three opsins and their opsin genes. There's a violet opsin gene and a green opsin gene and a red opsin gene. And I'm showing you that they're sensitive to different wavelengths of light. There's a fourth opsin gene for seeing in dim light. It's not part of my story tonight. I'm not going to mention it anymore. Now, the important part of the story with respect to humans is that only humans and great apes and old world monkeys, in other words, old world primates, have this capability of full color vision among all mammals. So if you ever wondered what your dog or cat or guinea pig can see, not what you can. A more limited visual spectrum. But we can see in full color. Now, some other animals can too, such as birds. And I'll tell you a little bit more about birds shortly as I get back to the kestrel story. Now, we know, in fact, that only old world primates have this capability, and they have this capability because they possess a third opsin gene, an extra gene in this green-red pair, that other mammals don't have. We can actually trace that through history and see that other mammals don't have that capability. So sometime deep in our ancestry in Africa, that gene arose. And in fact, we know the exact boundaries of how that gene arose. We got a pretty good forensic signature of the origin of that gene. So why would that have been important? Just to give you a little feel for why would full color vision have been important in our ancestors? Well, this has been studied a lot by primate biologists. And to illustrate this, the best way I can do this, I'm going to take the lights down just a little bit here and show you a clip. Now, I need you to pay close attention to this clip. I'm going to show it to you twice. It only lasts about 8 seconds. I'm going to show you a clip of a red colobus monkey in Zanzibar. And what I want you to pay attention to is as it walks through the forest canopy is what it eats and especially what it doesn't eat. So here it is. Here's the monkey surrounded by this lush foliage. And watch, reaches for those leaves. Could you see what it ate? Maybe those up front? We'll show it one more time. Here it is. It's ignoring all of the green leaves, and those of you who could see it, it reaches for and eats yellow and red leaves. Now, without full color vision, that animal could not distinguish green from red. But with color vision, it can. And why does that matter? Well, those red and yellow leaves are younger, more nutritious, and easier to digest. And in fact, those green leaves are often toxic. So cruising through the canopy, our primate relatives and ancestors were able to distinguish good from bad leaves much more readily. And the same colors distinguish, the same color scheme and capabilities apply to fruits. So they ignore, for example, green fruit and often eat yellow and red fruit. And this is well documented, as I said, by primate biologists in the field. So we think that somewhere in our history, this capability was important, gave these animals an advantage. And one way to think about this advantage is, in fact, that there are no old world primates that lack full color vision. So if there were at one time, they've been outcompeted by these sharp-eyed primates. Okay, so now that I've given you a little feel for the significance of full color vision, you may remember a long time ago I was telling you about kestrels. Okay, so back to the kestrels. What's up with the kestrels? Well, something important has happened to kestrels. If we look at the code for its violet opsin in this gene, there's been a substitution that's changed a letter in the gene and changed the properties of the opsin in a dramatic way. What I'm trying to show here by this shift from the violet out here is that now this mutant opsin, no longer sensitive to violet wavelength light, but to the ultraviolet. Now, you and I, this would probably be a pretty profound, perhaps a bad thing. It would change our perception of the world. But this has happened in kestrels, and in fact, all kestrels, all European kestrels, show this change. So that would seem to indicate that it's not such a bad thing for kestrels. So why do these kestrels have this mutation? Why might it be good for a kestrel? Well, it's because vole urine reflects in the ultraviolet. I want to point out, especially to the youngsters here in the audience, this is some of the majesty of natural history that you get to explore if you get like 4 science degrees. So these are field samples from the field vole. And as you can see, under ultraviolet light, they're reflecting. So what's going on? Well, what seems to happen is that the grass the vole feeds on, there are substances in that grass that will reflect in the ultraviolet. And the voles use this sort of for communication among the voles. And the kestrel is sort of invading that communication channel. And now think about its search strategy. Now it's flying over these fields, and anywhere where there's a high concentration of voles, which would be around the burrows or on trails, of course, there's going to be markings. And those markings are going to reflect. And the kestrel can pick that out with its sense of ultraviolet vision. And so it doesn't have to survey the whole green field. It just has to focus where there's a high density, a sign of high activity of voles, and then watch for a little vole swoop down, and it gets its lunch. So what I want you to get from these two stories are several things about that I think, in general, tell us about evolving genes. These variations, the mutations in the pocket mice or the mutations in kestrel babies, they arise at random. Every individual organism is born on this planet with a new set of mutations that weren't there in its parents. This is just the low level of mistakes that are made as DNA is copied. Some of those mutations can change the physiological properties of the organism, for better or for worse. But that process is blind. The mutational process is random. It's the selective conditions, in this case, the habitat, the lava flows, predators, birds, mates, etc. They determine which of these variants are favored, which form, which mutations, which individuals are the fittest. And I think this is the most widespread misconception about the evolutionary process is, how can a process that has an element of chance, of randomness in it, explain all the order and diversity on the planet? Well, it's only the mutational process that's random. Natural selection is not. Natural selection is a very directed process that's saying in certain habitats, these individuals are favored. They might be favored by a very large fraction. Certain predators will be able to, in the case of the kestrel, see food that others could not. advertising to mates, etc. So again, the fittest is a very conditional status, and whether a mutation is beneficial or not depends upon these conditions. Now, you might also think, and I can think another common conception about evolution, is that once something beneficial, something handy had been invented, of course, you'd never get rid of it. Think again. I'm going to shatter that notion. I'm going to stick with this topic of seeing and not being seen, but I'm going to change animals a little bit. I'm going to show you some other pretty creatures. In this case, fish. And I'll start with reef fish. Those of you who are enthusiasts or snorkelers or scuba divers appreciate that on coral reefs in shallow water, fish are very colorful. And these colors are used a lot in communication between fish. And these fish have full color vision. They can pick up the oranges and yellows and greens and blues, etc., on either the same species or other species. Now, in that shallow water, all the wavelengths of light reach, you know, 15, 20, 30 feet of water. But as the ocean gets deeper, most of that sunlight, most of those wavelengths of light don't reach. And the situation is different for fish that live in deeper water. So let me show you a deeper water fish. And I'm going to say, anyone under 22 who can identify this fish, you just shout it out. There you go. Are you under 22? I won't turn the lights up. Congratulations. The coelacanth, a pretty famous fish in natural history, because until 1938, we thought the coelacanth and all of its relatives were extinct and had been extinct for 65 million years. But the coelacanth was accidentally caught off South Africa, and now we realize that this fish is still alive. There's actually another species of coelacanth in Indonesia. Now, this fish has an important role in natural history, largely because if you see the way it's moving its fins, it turns out that part of that motion is very related to the way that we four-legged animals move our limbs. So this fish is a fairly close relative, a very good surrogate for the sorts of fish ancestors that gave rise to four-legged land animals that we eventually evolved from. So the coelacanth has been a very helpful and interesting fish in the course of the study of biology. But if you're paying close attention to that coelacanth, you're noticing that it lives in a really dim habitat. In fact, these have been observed now by both divers and by submersibles. And we know that the coelacanth pretty much during the day hangs out in caves and only goes out at night along the sea bottom to scavenge for its food, for example, for crustaceans. So it lives in a dim, if not a completely dark, habitat. Now, let's compare the visual capabilities of reef fish and coelacanths. So, in shallow water, where all wavelengths of light are able to reach, think of something like a beautiful clownfish. Well, we know this clownfish has color vision. And just schematically now, I'm diagramming its violet opsin gene. It's completely intact, functional, contributing to its sense of color vision. Now let's consider the coelacanth, living in this only, at most, dim blue light. Well, if we look at its violet opsin gene, it is shot to pieces. We can tell it's a violet opsin gene. It has enough resemblance to other violet opsin genes that we know, yes, it's a violet opsin gene. But the text is interrupted at four different places by mutations, each one of which completely crippled the gene. This gene is no longer functioning. In fact, it's been battered. It's a fossil. Now, how can we rationalize this? Well, these fish live in deeper water. And mutations that would have happened to this gene would have no consequence for a fish not using full color vision in an environment where all the colors of the rainbow aren't available because all those wavelengths of light aren't available. So this fossil gene having no effect on the function of the coelacanth, it's fine. What we think has happened is that as these fish have shifted to deeper water, this is relaxed selection on the violet opsin. Remember I told you, individuals are born all the time with new mutations. So there are clownfish that are born from time to time on coral reefs that have mutations in their violet opsin gene. But those mutations affect the performance of those fish. And those mutations aren't passed on efficiently to future generations of clownfish. And so that's why we see this gene's always intact. But when you look at the coelacanth, mutations in this gene have no effect. So mutations can just pile up in the gene, battering it away as a molecular fossil. So here's a case where mutations are neither advantageous nor injurious. Natural selection is blind to them because they have no effect on the performance of the animal. And we can rationalize this if we know, since it has a violet opsin gene, its ancestors probably had full color vision at some point and shifted to a deep water lifestyle. And that shift is reflected now in a fossilized opsin gene. Now you might be thinking, fossil genes, okay, he's told me about fossil genes in ice fish and coelacanths. What's he talking about? These are only weird fish in the ocean. I want to know about animals that make sense. Are fossil genes just something you see in really peculiar creatures that live in really weird places? Well, not at all. And to drill this home, I'm going to show you some animals living in some other habitats, and this will start to make sense. So here's an animal living in a dim habitat. What if you look at an animal, for example, that is strictly nocturnal, like this beautiful owl monkey? Well, this monkey only goes out at night. Big eyes for collecting that dim light. But it's not out using its sense of color vision. It's not foraging for colored leaves or anything like that. Strictly nocturnal. And if we look at its violet opsin gene, same thing. It's been mutated several times, so it's inactive. Still there. That tells us that this old world primate had a color vision equipped ancestor, but not anymore. That gene's inactivated. And the mutations in the owl monkey are different than the mutations that have happened in the coelacanth. And that tells us that this has happened independently in these different creatures living in different parts of the world. All right? You getting the trend? Well, let's test this a little bit more. Let's look at another nocturnal creature. A little bush baby, different part of the primate tree. Same thing, strictly nocturnal. And we look at its violet opsin gene, same story. Mutated repeatedly and in different places than either the coelacanth or the owl monkey. All right? So we see a pattern here. The shift to deep water, the shift to being nocturnal. There's a signature in the DNA of these animals telling you that their lifestyle has changed from that of their ancestors. It's written right there in their opsin genes. Now, can you think of any other sort of tests of this idea? How about animals that have gone below ground? So I'm going to really test your affinity for the animal kingdom here. Subterranean blind mole rat. So here's an animal, has the most degenerate eyes of any mammal, spends all that time below ground, and guess what? You look at its violet opsin gene, it's there. We can still tell the code. The process of the withering away of these genes are slow enough that we can still catch these genes millions of years after they've started to decay. So that's great that they stick around long enough for us to study them, you know, in 2009. But they've been hit repeatedly. And again, the mutations in the blind mole rat are completely different from those in the coelacanth or the nocturnal owl monkey or the bush baby. Okay, you might still say, Sean, these are still strange creatures. Strange creatures with fossil genes. I'm skeptical, all right? Let me show you the strangest creature of all. Us. Right now, and you and I, you have got at least 887 fossil genes that are leftovers from goodness knows how many ancestors. 67 of those fossil genes have been fossilized since we split off from our common ancestor with chimpanzees. That means those are genes that are still working in chimps today, but sometime in the last 5 million years, hominids have mutated them so they're non-functional. So of about 20,000 functional genes, we're carrying around a lot of history of stuff that no longer works. It's slowly eroding away, so that gives us a nice sort of way of peering into the past, tens, maybe even 100 million years or more. And this is an ongoing process. Remember I said 67 have just happened in the last 5 million years. So as lifestyles change, more genes can become fossilized. Now, these old genes, they no longer matter. You know, they're sort of broken pieces of yesterday's operating instructions in the DNA. So what are we learning from these fossil genes? Well, I think we're learning several things, and they're all important. They tell us about lifestyles of ancestors. This is not really something we imagined we would find in the DNA record. It's really handy. This stuff sticks around long enough that we can say, oh, your ancestors had, you know, color vision. Your ancestors had red blood cells. Most importantly in the context tonight, This is exactly what we should expect to happen in the absence of natural selection. Use it or lose it would be a good motto. When natural selection no longer cares, when the contribution of these genes to organismal performance, to reproduction, to survival doesn't matter, then they can accumulate mutations steadily over time and wither away. Use it or lose it. And they really shatter any idea that evolution is a progressive process. Always getting more complex, always getting more sophisticated, capabilities always being added. Not at all. Some information gets irretrievably lost from humans as well as all sorts of other organisms. As lifestyles shift, certain genes no longer become important. Big group of fossil genes in you and I are smell receptors. Mice have about 1,000 of them, 1,000 genes for smell reception. We also have about 1,000 genes, but about half of them are fossilized. Our sense of smell relative to mice is terrible. Okay? Well, think about it. We're not living with our nose to the ground. We're living an upright lifestyle, using our sense of color vision to spot food, to remember where we are in the world, perhaps to detect danger. Mouse is using its sense of smell to do all those things. So that repertoire of smell receptors is important. But we've sort of relaxed the pressure on our smell receptors. So we're carrying around all this stuff that doesn't do anything for us. And lastly, weighing in on this question of design and nature, I would just ask sort of semi-rhetorically, you know, what designer designs non-functional genes? And I would say, at least as you are giggling, one with a great sense of humor. But there's something else about these stories I've been telling you about, the repeated fossilization of genes like the opsin gene. It's telling us that something we probably could never tell just looking at animals from the outside. When you look in the DNA record, evolution has repeated itself. In those opsin genes, that gene has become fossilized several times in different species and in different parts of the world. And it raises the prospect that maybe evolution is not only more reproducible, but maybe a little more predictable than we ever imagined. I'd bet you some amount of money. Look at more nocturnal animals, you're going to find more fossilized color vision genes. So is evolution more reproducible? Well, let me give you some more examples. Remember that gene I told you about in the pocket mice, MC1R? Well, guess what? That very same gene governs the difference in appearance of the plumage colors of the white and dark, or melanic, forms of the lesser snow goose. All right? The dark form has mutations in MC1R. And the very same gene also governs the dark color, the dark phase of the jaguar, relative to the orange phase of the jaguar. And the very same gene governs the difference between the light and dark forms of the Arctic skua. And what's really remarkable here is these mutations in the Arctic skua are mutations in the exactly same place in the DNA code as happened in the rock pocket mice in Arizona. Birds that obviously live in a totally different part of the world. So yeah, evolution does repeat itself. And this is something we never would have imagined. We look at these species and we say they're so entirely different. We didn't imagine that the genetic ingredients could be so similar. The very same genes contributing to similar phenotypes, or the very same mutations happening in different creatures. Okay, let me show you one more example. It's one of my favorite examples, and again, comes from the work on antifreezes from Chris Cheng and Art DeVries. You may have been wondering, as I told you about those fish at in the Antarctic, what about fish at the other pole? So if fish in the Antarctic have antifreeze, maybe fish in the Arctic have antifreeze. And it turns out they do. But how did they get that antifreeze? Well, maybe some fish from the Southern Ocean swam up to the Arctic. That would be one way to do it. Maybe they invented that antifreeze in exactly the same way from a little piece of code of a digestive enzyme. But no, it's even cooler than that. But I need a rim shot for that one. So they have biochemically incredibly similar antifreeze. Really similar, the repeating structure, et cetera. So you look at that antifreeze and you think, ah, it's a dead ringer, it's the same thing. Nope. Not when you do the forensics. Not when you look at the DNA code of those antifreeze genes, we realize these animals, Arctic fish, came up with a biochemically similar antifreeze in an entirely different genetic way. They came upon essentially the same solution in a different genetic path. And they did so about 10 million years apart. That's another thing. These were invented at different times in Earth's history. This is certainly something no earlier biologist could have imagined. Similar genetic solutions to similar problems, but going on completely independently. Only in the DNA record do we see this in exact detail. So in fact, yes, evolution does repeat itself. And how can we rationalize this? Well, similar selective conditions favor similar genetic variations in different species at different times and in different parts of the world. So evolution is far more reproducible and therefore more predictable than we ever thought. And as we mine this record, and there's many more examples of the repetition of evolution and many more examples of adaptation, I'll spare you those. But thanks to this DNA record, those of us working today see this as a new golden age in evolutionary science, where we can pinpoint precisely the genetic changes responsible for the evolutionary process. Now, I say it's a new golden age. Well, that's the first golden age would have been Darwin and Wallace and Bates in the tropics, right? So now we really can see this process in full detail. And that excitement and that power, I think, is people are becoming more generally aware of this. If you look at things like this Time magazine cover, from a couple years back, just as the chimpanzee genome was sequenced, you know, we now have not just the human genome sequence and the sequence from now, thousands of humans, but of chimpanzees, macaques, gorillas, soon the complete sequence of Neanderthals, our closest cousin, barely even a cousin. The chimpanzee is, in terms of the single letter copy of DNA, only one out of 100 letters of its DNA differ from us. So, of course, we're most interested in pinpointing those differences that make chimps chimps and humans humans. And that power, as I said, I think it's dawning general public awareness that we're now in that position. So I think that excitement is one dividend of this new golden age. You know, there's been no better time to be an evolutionary biologist than, say, maybe 1860. Now, I'd be remiss not to acknowledge that while it's a golden age for the science, well, it's still the dark age for some people.
Senator McCain, this comes from a Politico.com reader and was among the top vote getters in our early rounds. They want a yes or no. Do you believe in evolution?
Yes.
I'm curious, is there anybody on the stage that does not agree and believe in evolution?
Yeah. Here's your instant replay. Just like they do on ESPN. So there's a score for you, 3. Representative Tancredo, Governor Huckabee, and Senator Brownback. And it's pretty amazing, jaw-dropping, that these are public statements by public officials in light of the geological record, the fossil record, the DNA record, and everything we've been doing for the last 150 years. I sort of collect these things. I'm going to show you one more. Ran across this one a couple years ago. We've hunted for almost 150 years and not found supporting evidence. Okay, who's this? This is a state senator in Tennessee, and I'm just thinking, where were they hunting? I was going to invite this guy to, you know, come to my class in Wisconsin, show you the evidence. So, you know, what do these people want? They want an alternative explanation. They're rejecting everything I just told you and 150 years of geology and biology. They want an alternative explanation, something maybe they find a little more palatable. So how would they often characterize it this way, that they look at the same data, they just offer a different interpretation. Okay, so how would they interpret, say, one of the stories that I told you? Say, maybe the kestrel and the vole. It might go something like this. So, You know, forget the scientific argument. There's theological issues here. You know, first thing, as sort of Darwin felt too, you know, God, you know, she's got more important things to do than to worry about voles, right? And the second thing is, I don't think she would pick on voles in particular, you know, just to make them lunch for kestrels. So, you know, this is bad theology, not just bad science. So no, as I've told you about the pocket mice and antifreeze in fish and ultraviolet opsins and kestrels, etc. No. It's just mutations. Not miracles. Mutations. Now, I have to confess, I have witnessed a miracle. Never say never. But I think there's a silver lining. And the silver lining, I think, in the last surge of controversy in the United States, I think, is that evolution is being talked about more now than at any time, certainly in my career. And I think perhaps the vehemence of the opposition is more a sign of just how strong the evidence is. And they know it. And they'll do anything to distract people from that fact. So, and as I've shown tonight, really the evidence is only going to get stronger. We're now, I've likened this new phase of sort of drinking out of a fire hose. You can just go to these DNA databases with a browser and make a discovery. I encourage undergraduates to do so. We're gathering the data faster than humans can analyze it. So in closing, I just want to go back to where this great story of evolution started and where my story started tonight. And I want to share with you one passage that I particularly like from On the Origin of Species that I think sums up where we are today, or at least forecast where we are today. It's a long passage near the end, and I'm just going to show you over on the right some footage that Chris Chang generously gave me of the ice fish shot by a diver in the Southern Ocean. And Darwin said, when we no longer look at an organic being as a savage looks at a ship, as it's something wholly beyond his comprehension, when we regard every production of nature as one which has had a history, and when we contemplate every complex structure and instinct as the summing up of many contrivances, each useful to the possessor, nearly in the same way as when we look at any great mechanical invention as a summing up of the labor, experience, reason, and even the blunders of numerous workmen, when we thus view each organic being, how far more interesting, I speak from experience, will the study of natural history become. We are no longer savages staring at passing ships. The day Darwin imagined is here, and not a moment too soon. Thank you for listening.